Part 4. Jericho. Chapter 16. Chris. Kittering's quarters were away from the human crew, a little bubble of the Hanilambra homeworld. Here, he could admix the atmosphere to his own tastes, adding trace elements he didn't need, that humans wouldn't appreciate, but that would remind him of home. Dull, reddish lighting soothed his eyes, and whenever he wanted, he could play the staccato yattering and rapid percussion that was Hanny music. However, when Chris signalled him, she couldn't hear any music, and when his door irised open, there was almost nothing of him to be seen there at all, his things packed away in a row of plastic canisters. "I was wondering," she said, "if you'd stay or not." "This question is also being asked of myself," came the bland voice of his translator, in response to the rapid fiddling of his mouthparts. "The skirling of home is to be heard. Someday soon there is potential to fulfil, or else never to be fulfilled." Where his software had got the word skirling from, Chris had no idea. "Home and settle down?" she asked numbly. "That sounds nice." "The mournful and the joyous occasion," Kit confirmed. "The loss of a nurse recalls duty. Wealth enough exists for this."
"Yes, you've made your pile," Chris agreed.
Kit received a percentage of every pay packet he clawed in for the crew. On top of that, he had his land step winnings, and even the pocket change he meant renting out his shell as a billboard. People who didn't understand them said the Hanny were greedy, but what the Hanny really obsessed about was giving their kids the best start in life. Hanny biology meant they didn't survive to see their offspring. A nest egg to pay for a good nurse was all they could provide. Kit had considered Rollo the vulture's own nurse. No higher honour to a Hanny. She couldn't quite get her head around it, but she knew she was touching the surface of a deep friendship. A meaningful relationship between human and alien, on a level seldom reached. Kit and Rollo had been together for a long time before the current crew had met either of them. "I understand. Everyone will," she told the Hanny. "If it's time for you." Some human part of her kicked in then as she thought, "But you'll die. Don't go. Don't do it." Yet that was a human interpretation. Kit was the product of a different world and culture. Kittering was still and quiet for a while, his arms moving about one another without touching. His screens were a lucent grey that steadily lightened, as though a dawn was coming. "Soon," he said. "Soonness is relative. It is unsatisfactory to leave behind more questions than answers. When there are answers, perhaps then it will be the time." Chris was surprised at the sudden spike of happiness she felt, that Kit wouldn't be leaving them just yet. They were out in the deep void now, and at that very moment, Ollie was cutting the Amaru loose. It was, after all, the most recognisable piece of space junk in the colonies right now. Ollie would mark its position so they could come back for it if necessary. In the infinite wastes of vacuum, away from the throughways, the odds of anyone locating it here were infinitesimal.
"Jericho is out on a limb, location-wise," Idris told them. "Only one throughway goes to it, kind of the opposite to Tarakuma. Even if I took us direct, it's a long jump."
They were gathered in the command pod again, all five of them, and he looked from face to face.
"This is what we all want, is it?"
Chris touched his arm lightly, for a little solidarity.
This Trine is an old friend of yours, aren't they?
Acquaintance. Maybe. It was a long time ago. You know Hivers. But Solis says they never re-instanced.
For what? 50 years or more? Ollie frowned. You'd think they'd gone nuts or something.
They're something of a test case. Solis was being careful around Ollie after their previous clash, speaking softly, not facing her head on. Chris was surprised how shaken the Partheni had been by it all. Not what you expected from the genetically engineered elite.
What have you told your people?
Idris asked Solis frankly.
That I'm following up a lead that may be of great import to us, connected to the wreck of the Amaru.
Solis didn't meet anyone's eyes.
I have not mentioned the regalia. I don't like the omission, and I am going to have to report this properly, but right now they might be fake, and then what would be the point in stirring things up? If Trine confirms the provenance, then I have to tell them. I have a duty. I'm sorry.
She looked around defensively.
Great talks are required between us in that case, put in Kittering. Parthenon has deep pockets. See right?
The last two words were given Rollo's exact bantering spin, and Chris felt a catch of loss in her chest.
The wreck's disengaged, and the Jones secured to us, Ollie put in. If we're going to Jericho, then let's go.
The first thing Chris knew, Idris was triggering her pod's emergency wake-up protocol. They dropped into the Jericho system and were being hailed by a Hugh military frigate, demanding to know their business. It was, they were being told, not the best time to visit the system. Jericho was the last habitable world to be found by explorers from Earth, before there was no longer an Earth to be from. A survey team, exploring a dead-end throughway, burst into a virgin system. They found a planet a little closer than Earth, to a sun a little cooler than Earth's. Then they found a biosphere, crammed full of riotous life, whose biochemistry overlapped with Earth by at least 40%. An Eden, surveyors crowed. But then, the planet's biochemistry ate two of the landing party, and they quickly revised their estimate to a monstrous death world. But there were still scientific grants for that, and a permanent research presence was established only months before an architect appeared over the skies of Earth. That research team was intended to be the sole presence on Jericho, an opportunity to conduct pure research into a thriving alien ecology, untouched by humanity, save for the luckless surveyors. Then Earth fell. The polyaspora began, and Jericho received its shipments of refugees, same as everywhere else. Establishing a colony on planet was not the nature red in tooth and claw experience everyone had expected. Desperate humans in need of a home could tooth and claw right back, and twice as hard. Soon enough, settlers and scientists were developing crops for the Jericho soil and curing all the problems caused when the local life messed up human bodies. The planetary population climbed to about 100,000, concentrated around the city that had by then given the planet its name. Jericho seemed fitting, because the first thing people had focused on, given the ravenous nature outside, was walls. Then, originator ruins were discovered. The original survey hadn't picked them up, because Jericho was covered in a dense quasi-jungle, and the local life generated its own electromagnetic interference. Both factors made it a hard world to survey. But eventually, settlers had started bringing back stories of strange things from the interior, and the discovery was made. It didn't seem a priority until originator relics thwarted the architect attack on Lycos, and suddenly
life on Jericho seemed much more appealing. Hostile wildlife beat having your world torn apart by a moon-sized alien. Eventually, the war ended, and Jericho's scientists, backed by the newly formed Hue, asked everyone to please vacate so they could get on with their work. The Jerrican settlers refused to be thrown out of their new homes, thank you very much. This led to the creation of the Jerrican Resettlement Board and the ongoing attempt to relocate its colonists. This led, in turn, to the nativist movement's Jericho chapter, formed to protect the colonists' rights and to make plenty of other trouble besides. Idris had burst into real space at what he fondly imagined was a discreet distance from Jericho. However, its entire system was buzzing with traffic. It seemed someone had turned the trouble up to 11. The colony planet itself should have been the crew's main priority, but the Vulture God crew's attention was caught by one of the outer planets. It was being pulverized into an asteroid field, and its debris trailed along the curve of its old orbit for over 100,000 kilometers. Idris brought up images. The planet was swarming with vast factory machines like city-sized flatworms. Past the ravaged curve of its horizon loomed a great bristling lump of mutilated-looking technology. This was a Neyramathi locust ark, the Jericho system's very unwelcome visitor. Humans ran into the Neyramathi almost half a century before Earth fell. The creatures roamed the throughways with an apparently insensate hunger, breaking apart worlds for raw materials and ignoring any requests to stop. For the next few decades, humans and Neyramathi would clash repeatedly. Nobody had any idea where the Neyramathi homeworld was located, or even if they had a governing body. They just turned up, devoured, and built more arcs. So it went, until something even bigger than the Neyramathi came along. The joint human-Castigar colony of Amraji were fending off one of the species' vast locust arcs when an architect arrived to make the whole business moot. When the Neyramathi attacked the architect, that established the first common ground between the species. The Neyramathi really hated the architects, and the architects were why nobody had ever found the Neyramathi homeworld. Which didn't mean finding a locust ark chewing up planets in the Jericho system was a terribly comforting thing. Current detente suggested that they wouldn't proceed to munch on Jericho itself, but they were a strange, lost species, and there were no certainties. All of which seemed beyond the pay grade of Jericho's lone military vessel, the tired old cruiser Samphire, which looked as though it hadn't had an upgrade since the war. As if to compensate for its impotence against the locusts, the Samphire was bombarding the Vulture God with demands instead. Ollie had set them up with a cover ID as the Jenny Kite, in case people were watching for the Vulture God. It was only meant to fool a cursory inspection, not a full-on military inquisition. Chris spent a few fraught minutes liaising with a suspicious Navy lieutenant who couldn't work out why a deep space salvage vessel would be touting for work out here. And he had a point. She'd eventually sold him on the story that, as there was so much damn junk floating about in-system, the Jenny Kite was here to scavenge crumbs from the Neyramathi's table. She had a feeling their details would be on the next military packet ship out of there.
"They think we're in league with the locusts," Ollie demanded disgustedly. "I mean, why all the suspicion?"
"They think we're nativists," Solis put in simply. All eyes turned to her.
"Why?"
Chris asked, and the Partheni gave her an odd look.
"Seriously? Jericho is on the Parthenon's red list. We don't come here. It's prime nativist recruiting territory." Apparently nobody else had known this. Chris herself had only just learned the potted history of Jericho, and as far as she was concerned, the place was a backwater armpit.
"Well, it wasn't the nativists who stole our ship or killed our friends," Ollie said flatly. "Wasn't them came to steal our pilot either."
"Enough of that," Idris said sharply, or at least as sharply as he said anything.
"The Salvation Orbital's Kybernet is calling," Chris noted. "We're docking there?"
"It's closest to the dig."
Idris had found some survey maps, which showed various arboreal topologies, lowland forests, upland forests, supermarine forests, polar forests, and although forest was a human term, it seemed fairly appropriate here.
"There's an elevator planet side there. It's probably the closest we can get. Direct orbit to surface flight isn't advised, because there's a crap ton of interference within the atmosphere. Partly the local life forms, partly the originator ruins, they think. These are the biggest anyone ever found, except they're all buried under the jungle, so no one's quite sure how big."
"What sort of interference?"
Ollie obviously didn't like the sound of that.
"Weird sorts,"
Idris said unhelpfully, but then sent over the data. Apparently the native life was constantly shifting the EM bandwidths they put out. Scientists reckoned they were competing to drown one another out or to locate their prey. But for this reason, the survey teams had recommended switching between algorithms to maintain communications.
"Why can't we ever go anywhere nice?" the drone specialist complained. "You know, maybe this time I'll stick in orbit, where I won't suddenly lose contact with my fucking legs."
There were plenty of ships at Salvation Orbital. The elevator terminus was 90% dock, 10% a rat run of doors and compartments surrounding the elevator. A single thronging establishment was ostensibly an eatery, but seemed to be doubling up as a drug den, gambling emporium, and synthetic brothel. The hub was crowded, all elbows and shoulders, and the stink of unwashed bodies. Usually, Chris gathered, it was a ghost town. Right now, there were off-duty military and the crews of 20 ships all jostling for room. She saw the blue and white badge of the nativists proudly displayed on collars, on chests, even tattooed across the bare back of one scrawny drunken spacer.
"This can't just be down to the locusts," Chris hissed at the others as they pushed through the crowd.
She had her slate out and was skipping through the media-type channels, searching the news.
"Blessed equity. There's timing for you," she spat. "A hegemony diplomat turned up at Berlinhof a few days ago, suggesting that Hugh should cede Jericho. It should make good on its promises to evict everyone and hand the planet over."
"And why?"
Idris asked, incredulous. "It's the originator stuff. The Essiel claim to be the old guy's heirs, or that's how it translates. And I guess Jericho's got ruins big enough to impress even them." Chris shook her head. "Look, I need to get us passage down to the surface. Solis, I don't suppose your lot have any secret back way in. So now you're happy to be working with the Parthenon?" Chris cocked an eye at her. "Look, that was all Ollie, and she's not here." "Ollie had a point, though," Solis said shortly. "How we came about, maybe how we could end up, and jokers like this." A wave at three tables of nativist spacers, voices raised in a drunken chorus of "the green we lost, the fields of home." "They spit on us, and it drives us further towards becoming that thing. I don't know what to say to her, Chris." That made two of them, because Chris didn't know what to say either. Except, "Wait, so you're saying there is a secret Partheni handshake? I have made contact with Trine, and they will authorise our descent.
They can do that?
They are senior researcher on the dig. They...
Solis actually looked shifty, which was a new one.
I think they're in some trouble of their own. You know nativists and hivers.
Chris had seen plenty of anti-hiver propaganda in her time. Boots stomping on knots of squirming bugs. Discontent about the hive intelligences winning free from their creators. Nobody wanted their appliances demanding independence. Or that was the nativist message.
So, are we just walking into more trouble if we head down there?
Idris barked out a mirthless laugh.
You know what we've got on the ship. I mean trouble. Us. Who'd have thought it?
There was a distinctly hysterical tremble to his voice. Chris put a hand on his arm. You want to wait on the ship? It's no bother. Solis and I can...
No, I'm sorry.
He shook his head, embarrassed. Be good to see Trine again.
Old times, hm?
Chris's slate pinged to say they had access to the elevator. She wondered who'd just been bumped and hoped it was either a betrayed activist or some pompous cult hierograve. They ended up sharing the elevator car with a real slice of the planet's current turbulent life. Biologists, hegemony cultists, Hugh military, colonial agriculturalists, and nativists. No guns were permitted in the elevator, but this was a wild frontier-type planet. Chris knew there would be plenty in the luggage compartment. Pills, people, Chris reminded the others as they descended, and popped her own. Most colony planets had their own version, a vaccination and antidote combination. Otherwise, a world could start killing you the moment you stepped onto the surface.
Why is that guy looking at you? Solis asked Idris, making him jump.
What guy?
Don't look. Then how can I...
Chris scanned the room from the corner of her eye, catching who Solis meant on the second pass. Half a head taller than the rest, and of decidedly healthier physique than the average colonial. His lips moved as he stared at Idris, talking into a communicator in his lapel. He wore a shapeless poncho that failed to hide the broadness of his frame, but Chris caught a glimpse of bottle-green fabric at his neck.
Where have I seen that colour? Ah, right. I don't want to alarm anyone, but his Voyenni.
Like the clowns who snatched Idris back on Roshu? She murmured.
Can't be, Solis said. What are the odds?
Their chief was spouting a lot of that good of humanity business when he was leaning on me, Idris pointed out, right out of the nativist playbook.
It made a depressing kind of sense, Chris thought. The Magda Boyarin were the acceptable face of nativism, and Jericho was prime recruiting territory for the movement right now.
We can only hope they have bigger fish to fry, Chris decided, nodding at the hegemony's cult members.
She just hoped the betrayed and the cultists could keep their knives to themselves, at least until they escaped the elevator.